This is the call to adventure. A hero in the Celtic myths very frequently is following an animal in the forest. The animal kind of keeps avoiding and lures him into parts of the forest he's never been in before, and then the adventure starts. Or someone will say, look, they've run off with Helen of Troy, so let's all get going and get her back again. Something may be stolen, taken away. Or someone will say, as it said to Perseus, go get Medusa's head, you can have this job. So he has to go do that. One thing or another will be the summons or call to adventure, and we'll call that the call. Now there are two kinds of starting out to adventure. One is the one that is yours. It has come to you in the way of an inner voice or a readiness for a certain kind of adventure. The other is following a crowd. That's not being your adventure. If it's going to be your adventure, there will appear, as you approach what I call the threshold of adventure, the threshold of real danger, getting out of bounds, there will appear a little guiding voice. I'm calling this magical aid. A little dwarf, a little animal, a little worm will say, where are you going? And you will say, such and such and such and such. And the voice will say, well, this is very dangerous. You can't do that. And you will say, yes, but I know I'm going to do it. And they'll say, well, here's a little thought to hold in your mind. Or here's a little trinket to have hanging from your chest. Or here's something else that's going to guide you and protect you and carry you through this journey. You're given magical aid. You're a little guide. And when you're in trouble, hang on to that, kid, and forget everything else. It's actually a fact. Your adventure is your adventure, and if it is yours, the world will open. Where other people would run into obstacles and blocks, it will open for you. You get on the road and are thumbing your way. The car that stops has the people in it that are just the ones that can carry you that distance and give you advice and perhaps a $5 bill to carry you on the rest of the way. All that kind of thing, magical aid. But then you come to the edge of the world. That place psychologically that no one has ever explored for you, that you have to do on your very own. And this I call the threshold of adventure. Before that, you're in more or less mapped out territory. There are a number of typical crises representing this point. What emerges to confront you is the absolute danger of darkness. This will be represented in the form of an typical creature, a dragon, a whale. And in the Arthurian romance, it's often a knight in black armor with visor down, so it's just this impersonal monster. And when he is defeated and the visor is taken off, he's the hero's brother. The brother battle dragon battle, Jonah in the whale's belly. The whale comes and the whale is the abyss, swallows him down, whale's belly. In the whale's belly, the hero goes into the abyss alive. In the crucifixion, he goes in dead. The cross, I've told you, is the symbol of the world. He goes through the cross, goes through the midpoint, leaves the four dimensions behind him, goes through the midpoint, the sun door. This is the image of what the Germans call the Klappfelsen, the Symplegades, the clashing rocks, the pair of opposites, good and evil, true and false, this and that. You're going through it. You go through just at the moment when the crash comes. A number of years ago, I went to visit Carl Jung in his castle at Bollingen. an awful time finding it. Every time I went down the road and asked where is Bollingen, they'd point me the other direction. And finally, I came to this realization that that little road there was it. And going through the road, I had no song soon across it with Gene in the car. We crossed a railroad track, and one of these absolutely silent Swiss electric trains came zoom behind us. And I thought, boy, the Symplegades, we're in. So you have the dismemberment, the going into the underworld, what is called the night sea journey. And now, moving toward the nadir, the exact opposite of everything you've been taught, you experience a series of increasingly terrible and terrifying tests. This has become, in many folk mythologies, a very popular theme. The hero who simply is depicted surviving tests. Then, and now we come to the critical crisis, comes the realization. Now this is rendered in four different ways, each way representing a sort of style of thought, a mood or mode, a style of mythology. Put them down as A, B, C, D. A is the Hieros Gamos, the sacred marriage. That is to say, the union of pairs of opposites in male-female term. The hero marries the goddess. The nymph is married to the god. This is the virgin birth motif. The symbology of pairs of opposites united, of temporal and eternal principles identified, is rendered in terms of the sexual polarity. This is the way of most of the fairy tales, many of the classical myths, infinite number of Oriental myths, and so forth. The second kind of crisis is that of father at one-ment, atonement. Now this can be depicted as atonement, as it is in the biblical tradition, where we are atoned with the Father, or as at-one-ment, when Christ says, I and the Father are one. The word atonement actually is made up of these two, and it has these two different meanings. This is the way in patriarchal mythologies, in which case, very often, the last test and temptation is that of a sexual temptation. The temptation of sex as the final temptation to be transcended, the ascetic tradition. These are the ways of the mythologies that we're most familiar with. The third way is what I call apotheosis, where the hero realizes that he is the divine being himself. This is the way of the Buddha, who becomes the Buddha. He isn't atoned with any father, he isn't united with any goddess. He realizes, tatvamasi, thou art that, I am that. That is full realization. These are the three high modes of realization symbolized in the high religions. There is a fourth motif, which is that of many of the most popular and vivid myths. It is that of the fire or bride theft. Prometheus stealing the fire from the guardians, male or female. This represents a kind of violence. You have come with the purpose of achieving one aspect of the total goal. You grab it, and not having appeased all the forces on the way down, you become assailed then by those unpropitiated powers. And there is then necessary a flight. This is the way of quest. That's the first half of the story. Now comes the way of return. Dante went through the three worlds, but came back and wrote about it. If this has been the mode of achievement, we will have flight, what's called the magic flight. Or we may have a return that is protected by the powers, return. You know the magic flight, it's very favorite of the fairy tales. The hero or little Hansel and Gretel or somebody like this are running away from a pursuing monster, and they throw things over their shoulder, they throw a comb over, it becomes a forest, and the monster comes through, until finally we get to the threshold again, back to the light world, and you're out. Now this threshold of return is no joke. It is very often more difficult than the quest. Here you were following your lure, the allure of the unknown. Now you're going back to something that you had left behind. It's a little bit like getting back into a wet bathing suit. There are a couple of junctures possible. Let me imagine, for instance, a young man from Wisconsin whose father was a rather stern cattle butcher or something like that. He thought this an unlikely life for himself, so he goes in quest. He comes to California, let's say, and with the aid of a number of nymphs goes through a long season of quest for his own spirit and his own art and his own inspiration and so forth, and by golly, in the hot baths of Esalen, it comes to him. And this is lovely and fine, and now he's going to go back with what he's found. He's been able to jot a few things down, or perhaps make some paintings or something, and he's going back to the world to present them. And he's heard that 57th Street, New York, is the place of all the galleries and all the publishers and all. So he comes with his offering, and they look at it and they say, "So what?" Well, that's a pretty bad jolt. Three responses you may make. One is, to hell with him. I'll go back to the hot bath. Stay there. And why not? They don't deserve what you've got. You've found it. It's great. This is called the Pratyeka Buddha, the one who remains a Buddha for himself. Perfectly valid, perfectly standard way. Second way is to look around and just see, well, what are they buying? You have learned something. You are stronger than they. You have been out. You do have a perspective on them. You didn't give them what they want, full tilt. So go ahead. You can become a commercial artist. You're going to say, what do they want? I'm going to give it to them, and you do. The only kind of commercial artist who is to be deeply pitied is the one who says, I'm going to go on writing potboilers until I've got my pile, and then I'm going to write the book. Well, what he finds, inevitably, is that his style has been determined by his potboiling period, and he can't write the book. It has died beneath layers of activity for the society in its own terms. You see what you've done. You've come back and you've let the society stay where it was. You haven't given them your jewel. And your jewel, it has a way, just as the monsters that follow you had a way, of fading at the daylight level, unless it's phosphorus. There's a book that is right now a bestseller. It's going to be in a movie. And I read the history of its production. There were five cynical journalists. And they said, the books that are selling have certain characteristics. Let's write the worst book we can write with these characteristics. It's called Naked Came the Stranger. They assigned a chapter to each. Each wrote his chapter overnight. Then they passed the chapters around, and any literate sentence or reference was blue penciled out. They put the thing together. They sold it at an enormous, with an enormous advance. The movie is in progress now, and you'll see this fine thing one fine day. The final and third approach is to say, and this is the way of the pedagogue, you might say, how can I get what I have to give to them? Not just what do they want, but how can I use what they want as a gate, as a door for giving what I feel they need. And it's a much more compassionate approach. It involves compassion, not resentment, hostility, and violence. You can't give unless you're going to let the barrier drop that you had to put up to get away. All of the requirements are changed in the return. Here, everything that they were was enough to drag you away, and by gosh, let it do so and have it happen. But if you're going to come back, you've got to see those things in a kind of perspective. Almost in the way of the young New Guinea boy who has to worship the mask. Of course they're masks. Of course they're hypocrisies. These people don't know who they are. You can't blame them for that. They've never gone in quest. It's something to see beautiful young men graduating from college 30, 40 years later, as one does at the class reunions. Look what's happened. Where's Bill? This layer of social necessity has piled itself over him. He's still twinkling there, and you can bring it back. Hi, Bill. Wasn't that something? And it's all back again, and then it goes out. try to get the thing going. I call this, then, the delivery of your elixir. And the symbology is of the awakened world. What do you have to give? It may be just a suggestion for the elders of the city to knock the buildings in the most beautiful place in the California coast. Or it may be a new religion. Or it may be a whole new inspiration in the arts or whatnot. But that is the circle. And you ought really to try to know what stage of it you're on. And don't try to universalize this for everybody, as though everybody ought to be where you are. Some of those who look as though they weren't where you would think people would like to get may have been there and come back and done their job pretty well. Well, that's my little story about the Occidental cycle and the quest. Now, the trouble with the guru quest is, all you can do is what the guru did. He's got his standard system of how to get there, and that may be just as alien to your system of requirements as that original square up there. I think of gurus as squares. And those that I've met really are. They're terribly complacent about their situation, and any deviation from the program they have, they can't handle. This requires an openness all the way, and you don't know what you're going to meet down here. Well, that's that talk. And a couple of very good questions have been put to me. The first, which I think I should answer first, because it simply has to do with incomplete in the talk that I've just given. I said that when, in the Indian system, the time comes to depart to the forest, Ramakrishna had said there were three kinds of departure. Gradual renunciation, sudden renunciation, and monkey renunciation, and all I did was talk about the gradual one. I didn't give the other two. Gradual renunciation is as I described it, the preparation and the orderly going into the forest. Sudden renunciation, says Ramakrishna, is like this. A man and his wife are having an argument in their cottage, and he walks out angry with his towel on his shoulder to wash in the stream. And he says, "You shut up or I'll walk away, become a yogi, and you'll never see me again." And she says, "Oh, come on now, you wouldn't do a thing like that. You said things like this before. You wouldn't do a thing like that." And he says, "I wouldn't watch." And with his towel on his shoulder, he walks into the forest and becomes a yogi. That's sudden renunciation. Monkey renunciation is as follows. Someone goes into the forest. The family presently receives a postcard saying, "Have found wonderful guru, getting on fine." Or one is meditating in a Park Avenue penthouse, wondering about what's happening to the stock exchange. The only way to cut off is to cut off absolutely in this Oriental system. You don't even have a name anymore. You don't have any caste anymore. Everything is left behind. The yellow robe that monks wear is the robe in which corpses are wrapped in India. You look at a corpse, in the poor neighborhoods, the ceremony takes place in the gutter. There's this poor creature lying there, and the wife or husband's crying, and the wrapping around is the same as you'll see on the monks. I don't know whether our young people in the Krishna, Hare Krishna movement, Krishna consciousness, wearing the robe, really realize how dead they have to be in order to follow this way. And the dead do not come back in this life. It's a totally different pattern from that of the European quest. So much for that very kind question.
When you're talking about original Eden society, it sounded as if, you know, you come to the point, you know, this is what you said you desire. But I've been personally more and more interested with the creativeness of darkness, the creative thrust, say, in neurosis or a very bad situation that you have, throws a new light on your old mode of adaptation, forces you then to leave, looking for something new. And I feel some of this in the mythology. I don't know if this happened to be kidnapped, and this is what starts the whole thing. I wonder if you want to talk about that.
Yes, I have a little story to tell on that, namely the first of the Grimm fairy tales, the Frog King. Also, when you look at the Arabian Nights stories, so often it's where the hero stumbles that he looks down and he finds that iron ring and picks it up, and there's the abyssal the cave of jewels. It's where you stumble that your problem is and your gold. It's where you trip that your destiny should hold you. It's whatever your problem is that can become your career, and that's this business of darkness, where the darkness is. And sometimes it comes gradually. The call here is a rather sudden one, but it can become a gradually increasing one. So often in the biblical calls, in the book of Judges, God calls three or four times before he's heard, and it's, it takes a long time for him to come in. That's the return.
But that's, in a way, he's fighting against what he thinks is his enemy, which is really his friend.
Yeah, but look what he did to that friend before. I mean, it's really Esau he's going to have to meet. He did him out of a birthright.
Yeah.
Thomas Mann handles that beautifully in the first volume of the Joseph and His Brothers. Jacob has cheated here, cheated there, cheated everywhere else. He cheats Laban down here, and he runs off with his wife, runs off with Laban's terebinths, the gods, and they cheat him out of those. And then he comes here, and he knows, well, I'm going back now. He's got all this load of gear and children and everything else that he's picked up on the way. And in other words, the destiny of the whole Jewish race. And he's going to meet Esau. Well, he thinks he's going to have it from Esau for what he did. Well, Esau is a kind of, you know, golfer and tennis player. He doesn't care about that side of life. He says, "Hi, brother, it's a long time. Oh, gee, don't you have beautiful kids?" That kind of thing. He had a terrific surprise here. I mean, this is a fellow who just had it easy all the way. But the angel is his wrestle with what he thinks is going to happen there. And he comes out, you know, with a bad hip. Everyone does it about that age anyhow. Well, let me tell my story about the Frog King. It's this one of losing something. The Frog Prince, Grimm number one. You know how it is. It's about a princess. Well, every little girl is a princess, certainly. And every daddy is king. And she has a favorite place. And her favorite place is right at the edge of the forest. Right at the edge of the forest. This reminds me of Rousseau. When you read Rousseau's Confessions, he tells you in one place, he loves to look down into abysses when there is a railing before him. So he's up on the Alps setting that, but the railing's there. Well, she doesn't, God give that the railing shouldn't break. So where is she sitting? She's sitting under a beautiful tree. That's the tree of the midpoint. Between light and dark, its roots go down, and there's a wonderful little luminous well there that goes down into the roots. So that's the abyss, the tree's up there. And what does she do there? She tosses a golden ball in the air. That's her principal play. Now, gold is the metal of immortality. It does not corrode. Gold is the solar metal. It's the color of the sun. It's the metal equivalent of the solar power. The sphere is the sphere of the perfect form. All you have to do is read your Plato and you get that. So this is her own immortal perfection. She's tossing her soul around, so to say. And one miraculous day, it slips through her dear little hands and it goes down into the pool. She has lost her soul. And she's afflicted then by what is known as melancholy. This is the call. Life has lost its virtue. I'm on the rocks. Where is the joy of life? Plunk. So then comes the little magical aid. She's sitting there, and the being of the abyss is wakened, the frog, the little dragon. She hears the little frog voice saying, you know, all frogs have a jewel in their head, as do certain types of serpent. What's the matter, little girl? Well, she says, I've lost my golden ball. Well, where is it, he says. It dropped down in the well. I'll get it for you, he says. Oh, how nice, she says. What will you give me for it, he says. Oh, this is the beginning of trouble. I'll give you my golden crown, she says. I don't want your golden crown. I'll give you my pretty silk dress. I don't want your pretty silk dress. Well, what do you want? I want to sit by you at table and eat from your golden plate. I want to go with you to your room and sleep in your silken bed. Underestimating the frog, she says, okay. That's the way things begin. If you knew what you were in for, you would not do it. So down dives the little frog, and up comes the little frog with the golden ball in his mouth. Now anyone who remembers the ancient Chinese flag will recall the dragon with the golden sun in his mouth. This is exactly the moment of this moment of the little fairy tale. Well, she takes the golden ball and without so much as a thank you, goes tripping home. And he comes flopping after, saying, wait for me, but is not heard. There's a story told by Ovid of Daphne, who is being pursued by Apollo, and she running away. I always think of that when I think of this, but Apollo, like the frog, chasing Daphne, saying, wait for me, and she, of course, turns into a tree. She's really a scaredy cat, and suffers the consequences. The little girl comes home with the frog flopping his slow way after her, and she enters the palace. Now, I don't know what the geography of these palaces is, or what the architecture, but it seems the dining hall is very close to the door in this case. So she's sitting at table with Daddy, King Daddy, and Queen Mother, and little princess in the middle. And they're doing very well with their golden plates and all, when up the front steps comes plop, 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 and she goes white. Bang on the door. Daddy says, what's that? You seem disturbed. It's just a little frog I met. And Daddy says, Daddy represents the principles and demands of the world of society and virtue and all that. And Daddy says, make any promises? She says, well, yes. Well, he says, let him in. So in comes this candidate, and he's on the floor. He says, I want to sit at the table with you. So she puts him there, and that spoils that meal. So she goes upstairs, and he's up there after her, and she says, you could stay down there. He says, I want in. I want in the bed. Now, the story has two or three versions at this point. The one that I like is the one where she picks the frog up and simply hurls him at the wall. And when that happens to a frog, it's not normally good for him. But in this case, it splits in half, and there stands this beautiful prince with eyelashes like a camel. And the girl is enchanted. And the story says, and so they were married, and she introduced him next morning to Daddy. This is known in Sanskrit as a Gandharva marriage, a marriage of angels. No sooner is he introduced to Daddy than there is heard out under the porte cochere a coach drawing up, and it's the coach of the prince's land. Well, how come that this prince had become a frog? Anyone who's read this Freud knows why. He had been bewitched by a witch, who, as we know, is always mother. This is what had thrown him out down into the bottom of the well, or the sulfur bath, and there he was as a frog now. And he finds his princess, his soul girl. He has gone down, so has she. This is where their divine marriage took place. And now there is revived the land. The coach comes to fetch them home. Now they've got an easy journey back. They're riding along the coach. It's being driven by a coachman whose name is Iron Henry. And they're going fine when they hear bang. And the prince says, "What's the matter, Henry? Did we break a spring?" "No," says Henry, "nothing of the kind. Ever since your departure, there have been four iron bands around my heart." This is the wasteland motif. When the prince is gone, the drowned man motif that Eliot speaks of in the wasteland, you have the wasteland. We're going to talk about the wasteland later. This is a grail motif. So bang, bang, bang. There are three more bangs. And that means that the restricting, killing thing has been broken, and the elixir is simply the return of this fulfilled youth. It's an optimistic story, and I like it particularly because it has both ends. The girl's quest and the boy's quest are both brought together here. He has been thrown out. She has lost her own life and joy in life. And it's from the bottom of the well that redemption comes. Now, that little story has in it all of the motifs of the great hero adventure in an extremely, say, attractive way, in such a way that you would hardly know they were there unless you began to recognize them. One can go, there is no better school for getting to know what the myths are about than Grimm's fairy tales. There are a number of types. There are the tales that are simply smart aleck stories, stupid dumb Bertha and clever Hans stories, that kind of thing. But there are these stories of magical adventure, and every single one of them has a lesson in terms of this mythology. What that these stories represent, since most of them, well, most of them, were for children. The Grimm brothers collected them from the old seamstresses and so forth in the attics of these homes in Kassel and other towns of Germany. Their friends collected them and so on. They're mostly for children on that kind of the threshold from childhood to the world of adult responsibilities and so forth, which is one of the crises of the death and resurrection. And they're just wonderful sort of simple exercise offerings for anyone wanting to become familiar with the way symbols work. You can tell them to the children get it without knowing that they're getting it. These stories are great.
So this kind of story never develops in the
Orient. Oh boy, you have a world of stories like this in the Orient, but not with a different tone.
Yeah.
Many of our fables, and in Grimm's fables, Grimm's fairy tales also have come from the Orient, but have become adapted to the European. We know the little story of the girl going to market with the eggs, and she trips and loses all the eggs. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's an adaptation to Europe of a story about an avaricious Brahmin who would go out and collect butter in his bowl, and then he'd bring it back and store it, ghee, which can be kept. And he was planning, he was lying there with all of this he had enough of it now in a big sack to take to market and sell for a goat or something. Then he would raise the goat and sell the goat for a calf, and he'd sell the calf for something else, and he'd finally get a wife and of high caste with the money that he would have, and then he'd have a son, and one day he would be disciplining his son, and he'd raise his staff like that, and when he did that, it all went. And this story came in with the translation of the Panchatantra in the 11th and 12th centuries. Panchatantra is a collection of Indian stories on the fables on the skill of living, how to live intelligently. Also, another amusing thing, just talking about this, until a couple of years ago, the Buddha had a saint's day under two names, Balaram and Josaphat. The story of the Buddha life was brought into Persia and picked up by the Christians there, and it was such a saintly life that they thought it must be a Christian saint, and the name Bodhisattva became broken up into Balaam and Josaphat, and you had the lives, I think it was November 27th when these two saints were celebrated. Some more? Yes, violence will bring it about. You know the story of the Zen masters who will wallop their candidate at just the moment when he's ripe and ready and break what he's got. There's an American Indian story of Water Jar Boy. It's a story of the Tewa Pueblo Indians of New Mexico. It's a quite charming story, and it's very much of the same order. It is of a girl whose mother was stirring mud to make jars. And she was going to the well to get some more water, and she put her daughter to work stirring this with her hand, and with her foot. And as the girl was stirring the mud, some of it splashed up and struck her on the high thigh. As this text said, none of it got into the girl. Well, somehow or other, it impregnated her, and she presently gave birth to a child. Only it was not the normal-looking child. It was a little water jar. And the mother hadn't known until the birth that the child was, that her daughter was pregnant, and she was mortified that she should have given birth to a jar. And when the girl's father came in, he said, the mother said, well, the daughter's had a child. And he said, I'm very glad she had a child. He said, it isn't a real child, it's a little jar. Well, the little jar could talk, and it was a little boy. And the jar one day, and the grandfather was very, very taken by this little boy, this little jar boy. He liked it very much. And the jar grew up a little bit, and when it got to be so big, it said, I want to go down to the flat to hunt. The father said, you can't hunt. You don't have any arms and legs. Well, he said, take me down anyhow. So the mother let them go, and the father took them down. And then the child saw a jackrabbit and started rolling after the jackrabbit. And the jar hit a rock and broke. And out jumped a beautiful boy with all the turquoise earrings and bangles and things that go with being a Navajo. And he spent the day hunting for rabbits. Then the grandfather became a little bit anxious because the boy wasn't returning, and presently he sees a boy, a beautiful boy, with a lot of rabbits coming down the road. And the father says, grandfather says, have you seen my son anywhere, my grandson anywhere? He's a kind of water jar. And the boy said, no, I haven't seen your grandson anywhere. And when he saw his grandfather becoming very sad about that, he said, I'm your grandson. No, said the grandfather, my grandson was a water jar. Well, he said, and then he told them all about how it was. So they brought him back, and when the mother saw him, she began to cry too, because she thought it was a boy coming in, and here she, and all this. And so it went for a little while. And then one day the boy said to his mother, and this is the great word of the quest, Mother, who is my father? She said, I don't know who his father is. He said, Well, she said, I never went with any of the boys around here. I don't know. So he says, I'm going to find my father. And she says, you can't find your father. I know anything about him. Well, he says, I know I'm going to find him, and I'm going. And so she made him up a little lunch, and he went down to walk along the place called Horse Mesa Point, where there was a spring. And as he's approaching the spring, a man comes. He sees a man. And the man says, who are you? What are you doing here? He says, I come, I'm looking for my father. And the man says, well, who's your father? Where's your father? The boy says, I think you're my father. No, man, I'm not your father. Yes, it's the boy. I know you're my father. Then he looks at the boy. The father looks at him to scare him. That's so important. The test, the boy stands up to it. The man says, I am your father. So he takes him down into the well. This is the serpent of the well. He's the serpent power. He's called Red Water Snake. That's his name. And down in the well are a lot of women, all the boys' aunts and cousins. And they're so glad to see their child. And he then goes back to the town, tells his mother that he has found his father. And he says, I can't stay here. I'm not going to live here. I'm going back to my father. The mother dies. because she goes back to the father. The virgin birth, the crucifixion, the at-one-ment with the father, the assumption of the virgin, not to a heavenly home, but to a subterranean one, which is the way of the earlier mythologies, where it's the abyssal water that fecundates the goddess rather than the heavenly waters. That's that wonderful story, and it's very much related to this one here of the lost object down the well, and the mother has lost her son, and she goes down the well. The boy has lost his father, he finds him down the well, and so forth and so on. The way in which these archetypal motifs repeat themselves, this is a kind of summary, and I've had this in my mind for many, many years, working through many, many stories, and I can tell you that it really works. When I was doing some of the papers left by Heinrich Zimmer when he died, those that I put together in a little book called The King and the Corpse, in which there is that story of the king carrying the corpse back and forth, I sent the manuscript to Ananda K. Kumar Swami for him to check up on some of the details. This was in the early days of my work on these things. I wanted to be sure of my Sanskrit and all that, and he very generously did so. But I had put together a little introduction from some of Zimmer's fragments talking about the art of reading fairy tales. He calls it a dilettante among symbols. And he says, when you come to the world of symbols, everybody is a dilettante. You must be prepared for surprises. You must not go in thinking you know the answer. You must have your mind and readiness open. And he said, those who come in with a dogma, knowing exactly what the interpretation of every symbol is, are closing themselves to the opportunity to be smitten and transformed by a surprise. Well, now, if any one of you has read Kumar Swami, you'll know that he knew all the answers to all the symbols, as all Oriental gurus do. But in the letter that he wrote to me coming back, he said, I didn't much care for that dilettante among symbols. This, to me, was one of the waking moments, pointing out the difference, you know, between the great Oriental teacher and the great Western teacher. Here was Zimmer as a naive, know-nothing going along. And he, as he says, let the symbol activate your own imaginative powers. And don't be afraid to let them roam. Perhaps you'll come out with answers that are not those authentic to the piece, but they will be answers authentic to your own life and development. So we're going to, as far as I can, take that imaginative approach now. We can, with the Oriental symbols, pin them all down because they've been interpreted absolutely. But our Western have not. They're open, and they will talk to each of you. Each is ready for one or another order of myths. I've noticed in my own life, and I've been living with these darn things, that at certain stages, one or two myths suddenly seize me and are the guiding ones. And then there comes a time when they're no use anymore. Another series has come in. I've moved into another sphere. They can serve as beautiful guides.